Welcome to the Chef Leadership Academy Lecture Series, a series of lectures delivered by Professor Jagdish Sheth, one of the top thinkers in consumer behavior, competitive strategy, globalization, and changing demographics. He is the author of numerous books such as Chindia Rising and The Rule of Three. I hope you enjoy this lecture on the globalization of innovation.
As we all know, innovation has become probably the mantra of the 21st century, not only just for the Silicon Valley and the kinds of enterprises that we have created, such as Facebook or Google even. None of these were in existence before the start of this new millennium. I don't think it's limited to the cell phone technology, the Silicon Valley, the memory chips, the smartphones, but innovation has become sort of the real competitive advantage of nations. This move is worldwide, but I think what we have not understood is whether innovation should follow the traditional pattern where you invent, you get the patents, you commercialize in a domestic market, and then the international market is almost an afterthought, especially if you are in a large domestic economy such as the United States or European Union, and to some extent India and China. So this domestic orientation often comes in from utilizing or gaining the full potential of an innovation. So I'm going to primarily talk about putting a sense of urgency about why a company or a nation, for that matter, either through policy or through market processes, must think about globalizing the innovation the day they invent or the day they patent for files. That's the intent of the lecture, and we'll give you the rationale and all the challenges one encounters if you go global with your innovation. The move toward globalization of markets is pretty real. This has happened since the last energy crisis in 1974 to 78, which was a transformative change worldwide. The world became stagnant from economic growth. Nations began to agree that what matters is trade as a growth engine as opposed to GDP per se. Liberalize the markets to open up for each other or to open up for competition, not just the domestic entrenched players, but foreign competitors competing in domestic markets. We saw the abolishment of the GATT, the General Agreement of Trade and Tariffs, replaced with WTO. We saw this worldwide movement of privatization, liberalization of industries that were never supposed to be other than regulated monopolies or state enterprises. So the globalization move that began to take hold from, let's say, late 80s, early 90s, now it's real. You cannot have anything other than a global mindset up front. I will here talk from the innovation perspective primarily, as opposed to globalization from a policy perspective or macroeconomic perspective. Why globalization of innovation is necessary, and I have identified four main reasons. The first one is what I label as hyper-competition. Competition is now, as I mentioned, both from domestic and global competitors. So you take examples like Samsung, out of nowhere begins to compete with Nokia, which begins to compete with BlackBerry and has taken the market away. And in the long-term race, a marathon race between Apple and Samsung, from this vantage perspective, there is no question that Samsung should win the game because Samsung is already thinking global up front, whereas Apple is saying, all right, we invented great products like iPod, iPhone, and iPad, all world-class products, but only from the American market perspective, marketing only in America rather than a global basis. Now, if you don't believe that is real, then one can think about what happened to the PC business. Dell Computers remain mostly North American in its orientation. HP, Hewlett-Packard, also remain mostly sort of a North America orientation or advanced country orientation primarily, and they've lost the race already. The PC business is pretty practically gone from the North American domination. We invented the PC. We commercialized the PC. We are going to lose the PC. PC business. Lenovo is number one because they began on a global basis by buying out IBM ThinkPad. And therefore, they created a global presence. They have a global mindset. And by the way, it is not limited just to PC or to cell phones or to networks. Think about AT&T, large enterprise on the wireless side, but strictly North American. On the other hand, Verizon, by divesting or separating the Vodafone is already a global player. And right now, there is a global consolidation or a global rule of three that's emerging. And therefore, competition is very hyper-competition. And jury is out whether AT&T, without a massive acquisition someplace in the world, probably may lose out from being a global player. Great technology the company has. AT&T Labs, independent of Bell Labs, is a great inventor. But still, the jury is out whether they can truly survive in the globalization of markets and technologies by and large. Most painful example I have is Lucent. Great company. Basically captive old Western Electric to the AT&T or the Bell system. With the breakup of the Bell system, they had seven baby Bells plus AT&T and a few other customers, only eight, nine customers. Could not think about globalizing, which is an irony because Western Electric earlier was a global enterprise, and only 1956 consent decree, as it is called, between AT&T and the government, they decided that AT&T manufacturing, Western Electric, will focus back domestically, divest companies called ITT, European Investment, Canada, which became Northern Telecom or Nortel, and Japan became NTT. But now globalization was very necessary. It did not happen. Merged with Alcatel, but even Alcatel-Lucent combination is still limited to advanced countries and they're not into emerging markets. And out of nowhere, Huawei Technologies has come in and has taken the market away as the largest telecom infrastructure manufacturer. Same thing about the Tata T is number two out of nowhere and has a huge backward integration advantage of plantations of their own. Fascinating to see. Here is Unilever, which is a global enterprise, but somehow has not been able to think through properly about its global architecture, and Tata Tea is now becoming number two. So competition is very hyper, and therefore you have any innovation, you cannot simply say, I will do the old skimming strategy, selectively invest in capacity, selectively market, keep prices high, and then gradually move to international markets with lower price points. Those theories are becoming obsolete because of the globalization of the markets by and large. Related to that one, especially in the digital technology, is what I call economies of scale and speed. What matters in digital technology is not just the scale, but also speed. And that's because the marginal cost is so little. Everything is fixed cost. To recover the fixed cost, you not only need scale, but you need scope, which is a world market, but also you need the speed. Those three things have to come together. And that's why a typical company in a Napa Valley, where we have the notion of growing wine at my pace and I define the time when I will market the wine, how do you go to Silicon Valley? Just to give you a little more anxiety into the lecture, I already forecasted that by 2020, which is not too far from now, Silicon Valley will become and shift to Shanghai Valley. Shanghai will become, and that valley area, Shanghai area, will become larger semiconductor, hardware, software, application excitement than what we have seen in the Silicon Valley, which itself is a rise only from early 80s anyhow. Very fascinating. So that quickly is going to happen. And therefore, how do you go from Napa Valley to Silicon Valley? This is happening across industries. So economies of scale and speed is the other reason why hyper competition is emerging, and especially in technology industries. So if you are a Google, if you are Facebook, if you are in fact any one of the social media, you have to think global upfront to have your innovation benefited or shared by everybody in the world. Second main reason, and which is non-traditional, is the breakup of the big corporations if they are diversified business groups. Or even if they are not as diversified diversified, the spin-off values or breakup values are greater than the stock market value of the parent company, by and large. And so you saw recently Kraft Foods breaking it up from Mondelez, which they acquired Cadbury's chocolates people, for example, and then merged them together. But they decided now that the traditional businesses they have are slow growth and the newer businesses are high growth. The two growth strategies don't mix average out very well from an investor viewpoint, created Mondelez as a separate corporation. I have seen that at Wipro, the consumer care side is spun out. Wipro has become purely IT company out of India. While they began primarily as a vegetable shortening company and a toilet soaps, etc., they have become gone back that diversified Wipro consumer care, as it is called, and have gone global upfront. And of course, this is not a technology story. It's a story about enterprises, but quite often the breakup of the businesses requires to think global, and any innovation that you have, take it worldwide. The third reason why globalization of innovation is critical is the growth of emerging markets. Global growth opportunities are enormous out there, and you can't simply do it in a selective way. So emerging markets themselves are very big. Both cell phones and automobiles, they are the biggest markets, China specifically, and China and India together. China and India together alone on purchasing power parity measure, which is the buying power versus per capita income, will become a $10 trillion consumer economy alone by 2020. And in a GDP way, that would be at least about $5 trillion roughly is the estimate in terms of converting the ratio between PPP-based calculation versus the GDP-based calculations. So it's a large potentials are in markets that generally we have not taken our innovation for fear of risking intellectual property rights, for fear of having no political acumen to serve in these countries, having a fear of not knowing how to partner with local partners, whatever the reasons are. And similarly, there's an enormous growth that's happening in mature products like pharmaceuticals to go from proprietary to generic, all prescription, or to go proprietary to over-the-counter, which is non-prescription market. And those are phenomenal opportunities. So you have huge prescription drug industry turning on its head now, and all the legitimate large companies are now becoming also producers of generic products, not just Indian pharmaceutical companies, but we are talking about Teva out of Israel, largest generic company. We are talking about more traditional companies out of America or Europe. Have you seen the rise of private brands now? Interesting. Private brands are growing worldwide. These are either store brands, not by store name, but captive to a given distribution, or a new private brand that have come about, which have a very different marketing process. They don't want to advertise in terms of mass media. They want to be anchored to certain retail distribution channels or online for that matter. And that's a very, very interesting area for growth. And the last reason why innovation or globalization of innovation is becoming increasingly necessary is because in the race for innovation in general, there are only few winners and lots of losers. New product failure is just dramatic, even today. And we still don't know why most innovations fail. So what I will do now is to think about, give you a structured presentation on why most innovations fail, and as you go globalize, what should be the strategy with which to globalize your innovation. Most innovations fail in the marketplace. Examples would be Betamax in the days of VCR, for example. Examples would be Iridium, which is a satellite-based communication that failed miserably, and the cell phones took off. Betamax failed. On the other hand, the counterpart technology was created because there was a consortium of companies and they decided to go global, whereas Sony wanted to do its own vertically integrated business on a great technology, but it got limited primarily to the professional market essentially. Most successes in innovation are by accident and less by business plans. This is my consistent observation, that even if we succeed, most fail, but even if you succeed, most of them are sheer by accident. And for example, the cell phones, when I was working at the early stages process of commercialization of the cell phone industry from Bell Labs and AT&T, estimates by everybody was that we will have, in year 2000, maximum potential of only about 950,000 subscribers. You know how far wrong we are? We have to add several billions to make it right. Today, the total number of cell phone users or cell phones sold, the SIM cards, is already more than 4 billion, for example. Mind-boggling. Most of the market was not even in America. So one can think about cell phones as a great innovation, like television, which was a great innovation. We invent, we commercialize, and we lose it because we have a domestic mindset. And these failures of new products and innovations is still very large, despite a lot of prior market research and a lot of publicity. So we know about Segway, great innovation. Environmentally, it's very good from a sustainability viewpoint. Segway is the motorized way of going around in a short distances, but failed miserably because it was just too expensive. So affordability was an issue. Distribution was not right, so accessibility was an issue. So it is now primarily becoming a niche company, essentially. And similarly, Tata Nano, with big fanfare, they announced with the notion that they will have a car under $2,000 equivalent, and this was to compete against the whole family going on a motorcycle or a scooter, etc., with the husband driving, wife sitting in the back, or two children actually riding on the same thing and some bags. In rains, totally unsafe. So Tata came out with a brilliant idea, but it failed miserably because they put it as a cheap car. And people who want to buy a car, they don't want to buy a cheap car. They want to buy a car that everybody else will consider as an appropriate consumption or a conspicuous consumption. And so Tata Nano concept is coming out in a different way. Many companies are moving into small car market. For example, Nissan has done that thing very well. Ford Motor Company is doing very well. Of course, Indian company Maruti is the biggest one, and they really began the pioneering work, actually. So in many ways, despite prior market research and huge publicity, Tata Nano is declared as a failure because of the positioning that they did. It is also a universal phenomenon across both emerging and the advanced economies. In other words, the innovation failure in the marketplace is not just limited to advanced countries, but it is also equally prevalent to emerging markets. So the question back to the table is, why most innovations fail? In my exhaustive research, reviewing all of the things that scholars have done, consultants have done, research, etc., putting it all together, I find that there are six main reasons why great innovations fail in the marketplace. And we have to go back to that really, really most insightful comment made by probably one of the greatest management thinkers of the 20th century, Peter Drucker, when he said there are really only two functions of a business: innovation and marketing. While we know how to innovate from a science engineering viewpoint, as well as breakthrough technologies, especially computerization of everything to do, like a CAD/CAM technology, all that stuff where I don't have to do manually drawings, but it's all computer-assisted design, computer-assisted manufacturing, we are still quite weak on the marketing side. So these are mostly due to market failures. The first major reason is just poor performance. The product functionally doesn't work, even though you have innovated, you were in the excitement of introducing it, or preemption, first mover advantage, come out with a product that doesn't perform well, and market tries to use it and then basically gives up. Concorde Supersonic was in that category. It was designed pre-energy crisis, had no idea about the impact of energy crisis of 74, 78. It would have never made money for any airline. The two airlines that were almost forced to buy, because it's a part of the consortium, where the British Airways and the Air France, for example. Great plane, but there is no performance for the carrier, in this case, primarily the airlines. Failed miserably. Of course, they had a safety problem eventually. It was a noisy plane, first of all, more like, of course, a typical jet fighter kind of a thing, pretty much. But as a passenger consumer market, it did not do well. A second one is lack of relative value. In other words, you may have the product work very well, but its economics are not favorable compared to existing alternatives. So here's a great invention by DuPont called CoreFAM, which is basically basically making shoes, breathable shoes, out of chemicals. Works better, lasts longer than leather shoes, but they never really understood the price competition that will come from shoe leather manufacturers worldwide. And as you know, many countries that used to be strong in leather goods, like Italy or Brazil to some extent, have exited at the low end of the market and have gone to more luxury type, you know, leather goods primarily, up a higher end market. And so Corfam died in the process. They got a great, I think, a military contract to survive in the short run, but the mass market didn't accept it. There was just lack of relative value. Many products I find out there newly created simply don't have the economics of value creation built into them properly. In other words, not only should you have a better product, but it should be cheaper than existing alternatives to create a value for the customer. So that's really the second main reason. The third one is very pervasive, which is usage incompatibility. You know, we think about the buyers in the marketplace, but somebody has to use the product. In the household market, it's the consumer themselves. In the B2B, there are office users and factory users. So the new innovation has to be compatible into the ecosystem. And I have dandy examples where we design the products without knowing how it will fit into that ecosystem after the purchase. One of the best examples I know is dishwashers. Dishwashers were designed before we could have a 220 voltage, you know, distribution. We only have 110 in this country. It requires enormous energy. It requires huge water, hot water, especially. And most homes didn't have the hot water tank to use that much, etc. In the early days, you might remember it was a portable device because kitchens were already built. So you actually had two, faucets that you attach to the dishwasher, bring it closer to the sink in the kitchen and wash your laundry. Totally incompatible with the existing use. And ultimately, the only way dishwashers finally took off was to have it built into new construction, whether those are apartment houses or single family dwelling homes. So usage incompatibility is my favorite among all these, by the way, because it is non-obvious. Next one is perceived risk. Every innovation has some risk or the other. So these risks are very key to understand. And we have generally talked about three risks in the academic world. There are 11 risks, technically speaking. But the three big ones are economic risk, performance risk, and social risk. And therefore, a product that does not fit into the risk profiles properly seems to not succeed in the marketplace. Irradiated foods is one of those classic examples where even today, despite all of the precautions and the safety, people don't trust food with radiation. And therefore, its usage has been very slow. And in fact, there's a lot of non-disclosure. You get your fruits and vegetables treated with radiation, but they will not label its radiated product. Same thing, organic milk will be radiated, but they don't label it. In fact, they will call it ultra-pasteurized or something like that, because average consumer has an enormous fear of having, physical risk in this case, about being contaminated by radiation. I worked as an advisor and an advisory board member on a company, which is, I still remember, is fascinating, which is called a Grayson. University of Illinois chemistry professors had come out with a chemical where if you mix it with a cow dung and put it in a drum like a cement mixing drum, it becomes a feed back to the cow. Product works. It is certified by all of the certifying agencies. Basically, the chemical takes bacteria out of the waste. And cow's waste has still a lot more nutrition, a lot more energy, as they call it. Everything is there except for bacteria. So if you eliminate bacteria, it becomes a great feed, relatively cheap. But it ran into two main problems. One is the usage incompatibility. How do you collect cow dung in a large grazing Texas land? If you go to King Ranch, they probably have a total of 1 million acres, and out of which maybe 500,000 is just for cattle grazing. So you don't know how to run after the cattle to catch the cow waste or cow dung. Even if they put in a typical, you know, milking time where the cows will have cow waste, it was much harder. But even if you surmount that difficulty, think about the view of the food nutrition person at a major cattle ranch. She would absolutely refuse to accept this as a product because she believes if the word gets out that the cows were fed by their own cow dung, there will be no market out there. Interesting, right? So you have the social risk that is involved besides sort of a functional risk in some fashion, pretty much. So that's a very interesting example. Next one is tradition in the same category. Our tradition is very important, especially in the farming community again. So I remember a case study I used to teach where some brilliant young entrepreneur wanted to put contact lenses in the eyes of chicken. First of all, he said, why? But he has a legitimate case. Most chicken cannibalize each other. So historically, traditionally, you debick the little chicks before they grow. And when you put them into a coop, the cannibalization drops from 25% to maybe less than 9%. But debicking itself is a painful process. There's a shock, etc. So he came out with an idea that the best way is to basically change the perfect vision of a chicken 20/20 into blurring it with a contact lens, the reverse use of contact lens. And he got the contact lens from Bausch & Lomb or some such company. Now, how do you put the contact lens in the eyes of the chicken? That was possible. So chickens, where they don't see the size of each other, don't cannibalize. That was his theory. And it worked in experiments. But you go to a farmer and say, let's make your chicken high-tech by putting contact lens, you're going to see a major, major skepticism. He does not want to be the first farmer to be laughed at by his neighbors. So the traditions come in the way. In fact, traditions are one of the biggest, biggest reasons why most innovations fail, especially if they challenge the existing prevailing habits or cultures of the society. And the last one and the sixth one why most innovations fail is negative image. So Indian Machine Tools, great country, building heavy engineering products, but somehow the world thinks India is a country of roaming chows and snake charmers, maybe great philosophers, maybe good fakirs, you know, or sadhus or gurus, whatever you call them, but they cannot be in the modern industrial age by building machine tools for milling machines, drilling machines, for metal bending machines kind of a stuff. But India did good machine tools, and therefore the image of country of origin came in the way. The negative image became the key bottleneck. And of course, I did a major research project to show how to overcome that particular image problem by, let's say, aligning with Eastern European countries, having physical delegations who come to India and look at the most modern factory. And we wanted to make sure that in front of the modern factory, there is a snake charmer, which means you have these contradictory realities can coexist at the same time to change the mind and the stereotype of the people about India in the industrial age. Of course, today, India has advanced very, very well through software technology. And today, Indian scientists and engineers are highly admired worldwide. But that's really what it is about. So there are six factors. These all come into the play in a very big way in the rest of the world. So what are the challenges when you try to globalize innovations? And I find four major challenges, which comes from a framework created by Pankaj Ghemawat, who used to be at Harvard University. And he wrote a very interesting paper called Distance Still Matters. In the early 80s, there was a debate created by Theodore Levitt, who was another major professor at Harvard University, wrote classic papers like Marketing Myopia, and he came out with an advocacy position that standardization or globalization of products is inevitable, must happen. Don't spend money in creating separate brands, separate, you know, models, etc., for each country, because that's too expensive. Which makes perfect sense after the first energy crisis, 74-78. We were doing totally re-engineering the corporation, downsizing, outsizing, and all the stuff by and large, you know, and we were outsourcing. So it was a perfect article for the time, but Ghemawat began to question that in the 90s and published a paper where he came out with the argument that distance between the country that innovates and the rest of the world, there is a some sort of a distance, and he identified four separate distances. A cultural distance, which means the country has different faith system, different language, different historical origin, and therefore you have that cultural distance. Administrative hurdles, very commonly a country has their own rules, regulations, so you have to make product adapt to those rules, regulations. The geopolitical distance, do you have the same ideology as we have it? I mean, in America, we are very capitalistic, but the rest of the world may not be as capitalistic. Some of them may still have the legacy of communism, for example, and therefore their whole belief system from a policy or advocacy viewpoint is different. So geopolitical distance is one more area that he identified. And of course, economic distance, which means how mature or how advanced the country is. So you have the typical low-income economies who are becoming middle-income, transitioning out, and there are norms about what is the annual wage that a person should earn in low income, etc. And the question is that if you are an advanced country trying to do business with an emerging market, the affordability and the accessibility may not be the same. That was his theory. I think the same four factors are relevant when you try to globalize innovations. They come in the way. And hence, many companies not only fail domestically, but they fail second time around when they go international. We have typical examples of automobile companies failing, McDonald's failing at one time, you know, fast food companies, etc. And now they're all learning how to globalize their ideas and innovations. So how do you globalize? I've identified six different processes. The first three are much more true when you have those administrative obstacles or distances in a much bigger way. And then the last three are ones where those distances are not as prevalent or not as relevant. So the first major strategy is licensing. I'm a very strong believer in licensing as opposed to proprietary making, manufacturing, selling, and distributing your own products. Licensing gets you global very fast. And it often becomes a de facto standard. And licensing is that in each market, you have a local partner who has access to the market or he knows how to enter the market and they can expand. So you are basically having a thousand flowers bloom kind of a notion pretty much. I also find in my consulting work, especially with Texas Instruments, that often the royalty income on the same R&D innovation is far superior than the manufacturing income. I looked at Texas Instrument data, found $600 million on their balance sheet as an R&D budget, generating $1.4 billion in royalty. There is no manufacturing that can get you that kind of a return. And you don't have any headaches of getting the environmental approval, all of the union issues when you start manufacturing on your own, by and large. So I'm a very strong believer that royalty through licensing is a great way of making money if you have a very good innovation of some sort. And the examples are that IBM, while it is itself out of the PC business, actually still earns significant revenue because all PC compatibles have to use IBM architecture. I was on the board of a stem cell company, stem cell preservation, from the umbilical cord of the newborn baby. And these stem cells are stored in case the child, when they are growing up, has any genetic defects or difficulties. And you can grow the stem cells and try to repair or replace the damaged organs or damaged whatever it is, by and large. Cryocell International, we found that the biggest markets were Mexico and India. And both places, licensing was the right approach, and India has become a significant royalty generator for the company, while in the US market, they are just growing slowly rather than a rapid growth that would be possible. And as I mentioned about Texas Instruments earlier, the second major approach is franchising. So if you have an idea, if you have an operational excellence, how do you franchise it? How do you franchise your know-how, if nothing else, or an invention even? So more control over the innovation and the brand associated with it if you franchise it. Usually franchisor writes a very tough contract with each of the franchises about what the franchisee can and cannot do. So the examples are Starbucks in China, Coca-Cola in China. Coca-Cola is a bottling franchisor. And franchising is my next favorite model. Third one is contract laws are more enforceable globally. In other words, under franchising, you have a relationship which is contractual and those are more enforced worldwide, whether you are in the British legal system or the American legal system or the German legal system. So contracts are more enforceable, as McDonald's will tell you about the contract they signed with the franchisee. Kentucky Fried Chicken, KFC, has the same thing. The third major way to expand rapidly globally for your innovation is joint ventures. Good for capital-intensive industries. If you want to make an aerospace industry, licensing the technology to some emerging market, the cost of starting out the plant is massive. As would be true in movie making, whether you are a Sony or a Disney as a movie maker. So it requires capabilities across the whole value chain, and industries like aerospace and automotive have learned to start as joint ventures, and then eventually, if markets are relevant and appropriate, push out the local partner, For example, the franchisee, as it has happened in the case of Coca-Cola exiting India at one time, as it has happened, in fact, in many of the franchisors walking away from the market because they find that they don't have a complete value chain or the amount of capital required to invest is just not possible. So General Motors goes to China in a joint venture, and the Chinese partners take all the risk. Chinese partner invest capital along with GM, and that's the kind of a business plan that you create, right? So aerospace and automotive are famous for joint ventures. Invent here, market there. This is a new thing I have discovered as a very important strategy for globalizing innovations. Many innovations find unexpected markets, which has been a theme running through the whole presentation. And global opportunities are often an afterthought. Most companies start domestically, mentally. So examples are Air2Web, an Atlanta-based company that is into SMS and messaging. And suddenly they're struggling in the US market for whatever reason. In India, they're a major growth market. They've learned how to do it in India, particularly by inventing in America, but marketing over there. And the Grameen Bank, which began in Bangladesh under the social enterprise Nobel Prize winner, Muhammad Yunus. But Grameen Bank now working there is coming into the US in all major cities, primarily to lend money to lower socioeconomic social entrepreneurs by and large. And next one is Think Local, Act Global. I talked about Theodore Levitt, or Ted Levitt as we used to call him, advocating standardization of innovations and products worldwide, creating centers of excellence. You had a counter reaction that led to a phrase called glocal. How do you localize a global innovation by and large? Today, it is not think global, act local, but it is just the reverse. Think local, act global, especially in foods and beverages, because the variety is enormous. If you just go to any emerging market and go to a local bazaar, what you find in one market, only 4 or 5 kilometers away in another market, you will not get the same produce, you won't get the same products. And there are some world-class brands and products that one can take out of the very local nature and make it into global. So I find that very fascinating. Starbucks, surprisingly, is that idea. I mean, you have the Italian coffee shops where you sit outdoors in southern Italy, because it's a warm and nice Mediterranean climate. And Starbucks, the idea was brought over here, and basically the rest is history. Fanta was a great Italian brand of soft drinks. Inca Kola, another great brand for Latin America, mostly from Peru. And today, both are bought out by Coca-Cola to make them global brands, essentially. A single-use shampoo is a very common example we have given. Begins by a social entrepreneur in India. From a rural market, becomes metro success. And then eventually, it has gone to Mexico and other emerging markets. Especially Mexico, I am told, is their single largest profitable market actually. And of course, in alcoholic beverages, we have an enormous local variations or variety depending upon what you grow as, the raw material ingredients, the grapes, but also in the local taste in some fashion. And I think that's a key area to understand. And the last one is a very recent strategy people have talked about called reverse innovation. In other words, you really have the flow of innovation begin opposite. A typical innovation in the Western thinking has been to start with the military as the customer, co-design, co-develop. And in many countries, especially in the US, the military does not want to be in the manufacturing business. And therefore, they allow the technology co-created in the hands of a vendor or a manufacturer, basically a defense contractor of some sort. And so starting at that level, which is the old model, today in this Silicon Valley age or the digital age, one has to do reverse. Like the digital cameras, you start at the low end and you go upward. So that's the kind of a thing I'm talking about, consumer to military rather than military to consumer. Second one is from affluent consumers going into base of the pyramid under $2 per day income consumers. This is reverse. You start innovation in the base of the pyramid and take it worldwide and actually upscale it if necessary as you go to advanced countries. Actually, many of the base of the pyramid market offerings are now made into fashion expression or a fashion statement as they go abroad in many ways. That's happening with food, that's happening with clothing. Low-cost portable medical devices. This is a major, major reverse innovation strategy where it says you invent over there and then take it worldwide. So LDC as well as LED are very clear examples in lighting. iPad is becoming like that pretty much. You start with an iPad and then you make iPad for the industrial use much stronger, much more expensive in the process. And just recently I heard, I still can't believe the story about a toilet soap in India called Mysore Sandal Soap. In my generation, it was a favorite brand of soap, slightly upscale compared to a Unilever brand like Lux, for example, or Lifebuoy. So people who wanted to be aspiring bought sort of Mysore Sandal Soap along with others, what they would call premium soaps in some fashion. And I was just told that Mysore Sandal Soap now has learned the gift-giving market, and they have now come out with a one piece of soap, $15. Think about that. It's more than a good bottle of wine. And the cheap brands or brands at low price points are struggling. So it's a reverse innovation again here, where you begin at a low-priced product and upscale yourself, or upscale the brand of traditional products. So let's conclude this lecture. My view, it is becoming increasingly necessary to globalize innovations. It's not your choice anymore. Don't even think about it twice. And this is due to hyper-competition, corporate spin-offs, global growth opportunities, and leveraging successful innovations. Most innovations fail in the marketplace due to poor performance, incompatibility, high risk, social, economic, physical, and lack of relative value. I think lack of relative value is much more common than we are willing to admit. There are four major challenges in globalizing innovations. They are cultural, administrative, geopolitical, and economic. Distance still matters. And there are six ways to globalize innovations. They are the traditional licensing, my favorite, franchising, another favorite, joint ventures, less favorable because most joint ventures fail, but there's no choice. Sometimes you have to do it because of the capital intensity, government approval process of that particular industry. But the newer strategies are invent here, market there. Both ways, emerging market invention into advanced countries, advanced market innovations into emerging markets. Think local, act global, opposite of what we taught. Think global, act local, call glocal. This is reverse of glocal, where you start very small market, or bottom of the pyramid market, a given innovation, create an innovation, but then take it worldwide. And reverse innovation is related concept pretty much, and therefore it goes along with the same process by and large. So let me just conclude that the first three strategies for rapid globalization, licensing, franchising, and joint ventures are appropriate, especially when the four distances of culture, administration, or regulation, geopolitical differences, as well as the economic development of the nation are prevalent. And then the rest of them are much more versatile strategies by and large.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the globalization of innovation with Professor Jagdish Sheth. For more about Professor Sheth and the Sheth Leadership Academy, visit www.shethleadershipacademy.com.